quite rightly pointed out, the authorities leading up to the decisions in Gedin, Tibet, it should be noted that the first decision in Gedin, Tibet at first instance was in 2007, and that of course was before the comments of Justice Kaifal in Roads and Traffic Authority. At first instance, the plaintiff had brought her claim on the basis of both that the defendant had caused an injury, and secondly, that there was a loss of a chance of a better outcome, given that there was a delay in ordering a CT scan. The plaintiff lost on the issue of causation in terms of that there was an injury caused, but proved her case with an entitlement to damage on the basis that there was a loss of a chance. Now, the analysis in the court at first instance was there was a 40% loss of chance of a 25% better outcome. As Sharon, when she went through the facts, quite rightly stated, the evidence really wasn't at a level to allow such a finding, and that was made clear by the High Court. The defendant appealed to the Court of Appeal, and again, it's noticeable that the appeal postdates the arbiter of Justice Kaifal in 2008. The Court of Appeal noted that Rufo and Galvis should not be followed and that they were plainly wrong. They articulated that if there was going to be any change in the common law in relation to an issue of loss of chance and proving a case on the balance of the probabilities, that was the domain of the High Court only. It wasn't the domain of intermittent appellant courses. The plaintiff then appealed to the High Court, the decision of the Court of Appeal, and it's pertinent now to look at the standing of the international law in relation to loss of chance as at the time of the High Court hearing. There were three cases that the High Court considered in some detail. There's Le Ferrier and Lawson, which is a Canadian case from 1991, Matsuyana and Birnbaum, which is a Massachusetts case from 2008, and Gregg and Scott, an English case from 2005. The analysis in Le Ferrier and Lawson is stark and clear. The Canadian courts suggest that a loss of a chance analysis added an unnecessarily and impermissible confusion to medical negligence cases because it broke and hides a break in the causal link. That is, it was a way of getting around causation, and the Canadian courts said that was impermissible because causation is central to any common law claim in negligence. Matasuma is the case, or the one case in the common law jurisdictions that seems to suggest that a loss of chance is a cause of action and a plaintiff can succeed on loss of a chance. The case related to a man who had gastric cancer. He saw his doctor. There was a failure to organize investigations and diagnosed. Occasioned upon the delay in diagnosis, the cancer had developed to a later stage of cancer, and metastasis, i.e. the seeding of the cancer, had gone outside the gastric wall, and as a result of that, the plaintiff went on to die and lost the opportunity to have definitive treatment. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts stated that permitting recovery for loss of chance was particularly appropriate in the area of medical negligence. And they stressed that the decision that they made was limited to the area of medical negligence. When analysing what a loss of the chance was, their analysis was that it's better recognised as being an injury in of itself rather than a separate cause of action. The flip side to allowing for an injury such as a loss of chance and recovery on that is that it must bring in the concept of proportionate recovery, i.e. in the case of Matsuyama, it was found that there's a 37.5% increased risk of going on to die, And so there was an award of 37.5% of the total damages. And again, it's important to stress that if proportionate recovery is permissible and is something that the common law recognises, really logic would suggest that it has to recognise that in all cases. And that clearly isn't coherent in terms of the way that the law looks at causation. The common law looks at causation in respect to apportioning liability, in want of a better word, blame, and damages flow from that. And to go back to a stage, or to enter into a stage where the common law has to analyse percentages, it will make cases far too complicated, in my opinion, and also goes against the actual philosophy behind negligence, which is looking for blame worthiness rather than a scientific analysis. In contrast to the evidence in Get and Tibet, the evidence in Matsuyama was quite different. There was good statistical medical evidence that the plaintiff had lost a chance, and this was because he had a recognised cancer that had gone from one stage to a further stage, and there was a lot of evidence, scientific evidence, that the chance of survival, a five-year chance of survival at one stage, was better than at a further stage. So that's the first pertinent difference between the cases, that there was clear evidence that there was a difference in terms of a loss of chance. At first instance, the jury did not find for the plaintiff on the basis of loss of chance. They merely found that the action of the doctor was a substantial contributing factor to the plaintiff's death, and said that it contributed by an amount of 37.5%, and so damages flew from that level of contribution. So that was the way that the jury looked at first instance. That the decision was upheld on appeal, but the Supreme Court changed the analysis in terms of the contribution, and changed the analysis to a loss of chance analysis, while maintaining the but-for test, i.e. but for the negligence of the doctor, there would have been damage. And what they did, they identified the loss or damage occasioned as being that 37.5%. What Justice Kiefel says in Tibet and Get is that's all and well and good, but it seems that the Supreme Court of Massachusetts failed to take into account that the evidence was that Mr. Matsuyama would have died anyway. And there may be a tension between Australian and certainly Massachusetts law there, but it's not irreconcilable, because I think what clearly comes through from Matsuyama is you're identifying a particular injury. And it might be that the further analysis is that the real injury suffered was a loss of life expectancy, so that the plaintiff died earlier than they might have died. If that analysis was the correct analysis, and on the balance of probabilities that was so, I would say that such an identification of such an injury would succeed even under Australian law. United Kingdom in Greg and Scott, another cancer case, and as Sharon points out, many of these cases are due to failure to diagnose cancer. The delay in diagnosing in cancer in this case was a delay of approximately 1 year. The plaintiff went to his doctor in 1994. His doctor didn't investigate the cause of the plaintiff's symptoms. 1 year later, those investigations were carried out and the cancer was diagnosed. By that time, again, the cancer had metastasized. And so it was at a different stage to the stage it potentially would have been at the time the diagnosis should have been made. However, when the case came at first instance in 2001, the plaintiff had remained well and was in remission. In fact, the plaintiff on one analysis had achieved a cure. The plaintiff brought his claim on the basis that his chance of survival, his 10-year chance of survival, was lessened as a result of the negligence of the doctor. In 2001, he was 6 years into that 10-year survival period and had no signs of cancer whatsoever, was in remission, and that the House of Lords found that there was no evidence before them that in fact he had had a reduced chance of survival, because he was a patient who, against all the odds, had done pretty well. So that has to be seen as the factual background when looking at the analysis in Greg and Scott. And the analysis there is damage is the gist of negligence. And of course, in that case, the evidence before the court was that there was no damage. House of Lords went on to say that it can never be enough to show that defendant has been negligent. There must be damage caused by the negligence. And they also examined the notion of proportionate recovery and made important comments that such a notion does cut both ways. The High Court also analysed the state of affair in two civil jurisdictions, being France and Germany. There are very different circumstances in evidentiary burden in the civil law jurisdictions. The balance of probabilities is not the burden. The burden is closer to the criminal burden in a common law jurisdiction, i.e. the evidence of causation or proof of causation must reach a level of almost certainty. So that's the starting point from the civil law jurisdictions, a very different starting point to here, where again, as Sharon has said, that the burden of proof for a plaintiff in a common law jurisdiction on causation is relatively low. In France, because the burden of proof is so high, they've overcome the problems that causes, but by allowing for a loss of chance analysis. But that loss of chance has to be proved to be a certain loss of chance, not a loss of chance on the balance of probabilities. Similarly, in Germany, there is a high standard of proof in causation, but the German courts deal with the proof in a different way, and this is more analogous with the dicta of Justice Gaudron in Naxaxis. That is that once there's been negligence proven on the part of the doctor and an injury has occurred, the burden then shifts to the defendant to prove that the doctor's action has not caused the injury. And that applies when the negligence of the doctor is what is termed as gross negligence, but gross negligence is interpreted very broadly, and the failure to undertake an investigation at the pertinent time would be seen as gross negligence. So in Germany, there's an allowance for a loss of chance analysis. And there's also this shifting of burden to the defendant, where negligence has proven and injury has resulted. As everyone here will be aware, the High Court handed down the decision with a 6-0 result, a resounding victory for the defendant. The chief judgment was the judgment of Justice Kiefel. Justices Hayne and Bell wrote a second judgment, but it essentially said that they agreed with Justice Kiefel, as did Justice Crennan. In her analysis, Justice Kiefel went back to the basic tenets of the law of negligence and identified that in a medical negligence case, there are three essential elements. The first is the duty to avoid reasonably foreseeable harm. The second, breach of duty, and third, damages which result from the breach. Those are the essential elements of negligence well known to all of us. She went on to say that this incorporates both the fact of loss of damage having been suffered, and that that loss and damage must have been caused by the negligent act or omission of the doctor, and that liability based upon a breach of duty without proving harm or damage is not permissible. Again, going back to the previous High Court authority in Nixaxis, Justice Kiefel showed that what needs to be established by the plaintiff is that the more probable inference from the evidence. So the evidence doesn't have to rise to level of certainty. Again, the inference from the evidence is that the defendant's negligence caused the injury of harm upon a balance of probabilities. Again, she emphasized that did not require certainty. So again, inferential evidence is permissible, and so long as a jury or a judge is satisfied that that evidence takes the plaintiff to a level of 50% or more, the plaintiff can recover. Quoting March and Stramir, she went back to the but-for test of causation, but stressed that this is a negative criterion, i.e. but-for must exist to prove causation. So the negligence of the doctor must be shown to be causally connected to the injury, but that in itself is not enough. The test of causation is also informed by value judgments and policy considerations. And this, in effect, is again going back to the common law principle of, is it appropriate to apportion or sheet blame home to a tortfeasor for their action? And those are really the policy decisions and value judgments that courts consider. She went on to consider the issue of the all or nothing rule, i.e. once causation is established, even at 50%+, the common law treats the causation as being certain. That is, all of the damages flow once causation is established. So there is no rule of proportionate recovery. 51% is no different to 100%. On that background, she analysed the facts in Getin Tibet, and she said that the evidence did not establish what harm might have been caused by the delay of 24 hours or so in getting a CT scan. She certainly rejected the suggestion at first instance that there was a 40% loss of chance. The evidence really goes to a level of mere speculation or a guess was the height of the evidence in terms of what difference a CT scan would have made if it occurred 24 hours earlier. She identified the central question in the appeal as being, does the common law recognise the loss of chance of a better outcome in cases where medical negligence has been found, i.e. there has been a breach, as actionable damage? She answered that question, no. She agreed with the Canadian authority in that to allow for a loss of chance analysis would unnecessarily divert attention from the proper connection that is required between fault and damage. And that would create an artificial break in the link of causation. She re-articulated that the standard of proof at common law when applied to causation was relatively low, going back to these issues of it being 50% and inferential evidence being permissible to find such or opening up such a finding to a judge or jury. And she stated it merely requires that something was probably a cause of the harm suffered. And again, the authority is it doesn't have to be the only cause, it just, on the balance of probability, needs to be a cause of the harm suffered. And she considered that there were no strong policy considerations to alter that current requirement for the level of proof of causation. And she concluded in her finding, and again, I think this is important to recognise in terms of this case that a finding for the appellant, that is the plaintiff in this matter, would involve holding the respondent liable for damage which he almost certainly did not cause. And the evidence in this case clearly is that there was mere speculation or a guess as to whether the breach of duty had any causal link to the damage suffered. Again, very different to the Massachusetts case, where there was clear evidence of statistical analysis could be put as between survival and damage between the two stages of that person's illness. Acting Chief Justice Gummo analysed the case in a similar fashion, but he concentrated to some degree on the fact that this case was not brought in contract, and he articulated that if this claim had been brought in contract, the plaintiff would have been entitled at least to nominal damages for the loss of the promised opportunity. That analysis is based on the fact that a case in contract lies upon the occurrence of the breach of contract rather than the occurrence of any damage sustained. What those nominal damages would be, I can't tell you, and I don't think anyone would be able to tell you how they would assess. But certainly, Sharon will talk about the implications, but it seems that cases in medical negligence as a whole should be pleaded in contract as well as negligence. He identified the central question of principle in the case as, does the law permit recovery in negligence for a chance, opportunity or prospect of an outcome which was less than probable, i.e. a less than 50% occurrence? And he answered that no. The common law of Australia does not entertain an action for recovery when the damage is characterised as a loss of chance of a better outcome. Again, he analysed the issue of proportionate recovery and rejected such a principle. He spoke about the all or nothing approach of the balance of probabilities and described it as being rough justice, but it struck an appropriate balance between the competing interests of the parties, the plaintiff and defendants, and a move towards a loss of chance analysis would push, in his opinion, that balance too far in favour of a plaintiff. His analysis of the evidence was very similar to Justice Kiefel's, in that there was no evidence or insufficient evidence to show that performing a CT scan on the 13th of January 1991 would have even given a chance of a better outcome for the plaintiff. He then went on to state that the outcome of Get Into Bet will not require acceptance in absolute terms of a general proposition that destruction of the chance of obtaining a benefit or avoiding a harm can never be regarded as supplying that damage which is a just of an action in negligence. So he's saying this case doesn't shut out a loss of chance analysis in a complete sense. What it does do, it shuts out that analysis when the evidence does not rise to a level of 50% or more, or level on the balance of probabilities. So that the loss of chance scenario remains live, but on an evidentiary burden, you have to prove on the balance of probabilities that loss of chance did make a material difference. Justice Hazen disposed of the matter on the fact that the evidence was insufficient to sustain any argument that there was a loss of chance for the plaintiff. And again, I would stress that, again, that's significant in this case, that the evidence wasn't strong for the plaintiff in any way whatsoever. Justices Hayne and Bell agreed with the reasoning of Justice Kiefel. They identified damage as referring to a detrimental difference to the plaintiff. And they suggest that in order to succeed in a negligence claim, the plaintiff would need to establish that there was a detrimental difference caused by the defendant's negligence. They felt that accepting a loss of chance of a better outcome as a form of actionable damage, again, shift the balance too far in favour of the plaintiff. But again, importantly, went on to stress that it may be that other cases in which it might be said that as a result of medical negligence, a patient has lost the chance of a better medical outcome, for example, a diminution in life expectancy, differ from the present case in significant respects. And that takes us back to the Massachusetts authority. That case, I'd say would succeed in Australia if the plaintiff had characterised his damage as a reduction in life expectancy, and that clearly is, I suggest, is what Justices Hayne and Bell are saying in their judgment in this case. It's important to characterise what the injury you are claiming for, and if you can prove that that injury or that detrimental difference on the balance of probabilities was caused by the negligent party, you will still succeed. And they went on to say, what needs to be shown is that the defendant's negligence was more probable than not a cause, and again, it doesn't have to be the sole cause, it merely needs to be a cause of damage in the sense of detrimental difference. And again, if you go back to the authority in the UK of Greg and Scott, of course, the court there could not identify a detrimental difference, because although statistical analysis would suggest that there was a reduction in 10-year survival, that particular plaintiff had done much better than expected. So he had not suffered in himself a detrimental difference. So again, although there may be seeming tensions in the different common law jurisdictions, I think they're all coming together and coalescing into some level of coherence. Justice Crennan again agreed with the reasoning of Justice Kiefel. She suggested that the application turned on the fundamental principles of causation, which of course is correct, and that policy considerations told against the altering the present requirement for proof of causation in medical negligence cases. She identified those policy considerations, which will be familiar to everyone here, that it would encourage defensive medicine, would impact on Medicare and private medical schemes, and would impact on medical practitioner insurance. And she went on to say that the change, says Purge, it should be urged by the applicant, was radical rather than incremental, i.e. it was not in line with the way that the common law evolves in Australia on an incremental basis. In terms of policy considerations, again, going back to the Massachusetts matter, one of the major policy considerations in that matter was that the evidence was adduced at trial that the health insurance policies tried to encourage doctors not to investigate things because they wanted to reduce costs. And the court there felt that that was a good policy reason to attribute blame, because this person, in part, didn't have the test because the doctor hadn't thought about it, but there was a consideration of cost and a consideration of factors outside health. And again, that's an important policy consideration. The law of tort is about attributing blame, but it's also about trying to make systems coherent. Where you have a system where insurers are trying to encourage doctors not to do things at the cost of the health of those doctors, that's a positive policy consideration to put blame. In Australia, that seemingly isn't a policy consideration. The considerations are against encouraging defensive medicine. I'll hand over to Sharon now to talk about the considerations.
Thank you, Paul. For those of us who enjoy thinking about causation, Tibetan Get is a very interesting case, because whilst it answers some questions, it throws up others. There may be those who say, for those of us who find issues of causation really interesting, that maybe we should get out more. The clear implication from Tibet and Get is that a case can be founded on loss of chance only if the plaintiff can prove causation to the level of 51% or more. The question that arises from that for me is, what does the plaintiff have to prove to 51% or more? A straightforward or narrow interpretation of the decision is that the plaintiff has to have a medical expert who comes along and says their life expectancy has been reduced by, I'm certain of that, to 51% or more. That would be quite easy to meet. That is, let's say a patient has stomach cancer and the delay in diagnosis is 6 months, and there is good epidemiological evidence that says that delay in diagnosis, meaning that the patient's gone from stage one to stage two, for example, is there's a reduction in life expectancy of 30%. There's a 30% chance that this person will not be alive at 10 years when, if they'd been diagnosed 6 months earlier, there's a 30% increase in the chance that they would be alive at 10 years. Now, that's pretty straightforward. That is, the case says the loss of chance is 30%, but it's on the balance of probabilities that it's 30%. Now, I'm trying to introduce this interesting idea that does the plaintiff have to prove, is the question just that you've had a loss of life expectancy can be proven on the balance of probabilities, is that enough to meet causation? So if you have a case where there is this loss of life expectancy of 30%, for example, then is that enough? Because you can prove that on the balance of probabilities. Or is the case, and it hasn't been addressed by Get in Tibet, that you have to show a 51% or more loss of life expectancy? In my view, that's unanswered, and by Get in Tibet may be a case for another day. So if you were looking at a case where the plaintiff says, I've had a 30% loss of survival percentage over 10 years, and I can prove that on the balance of probabilities because I can line up 10 oncologists who will say that, does that meet causation? And I think that's a question for the High Court for another day, but I certainly think that there's a case to be argued there. A clear implication of this case is that you have to have good medical evidence on which to base a finding of causation. In Get in Tibet, the evidence at trial regarding causation was very thin, to say the least. There was the treating neurosurgeon who said that it was an absolute guess as to whether she would have done better had she been diagnosed 24 hours in advance with a CT scan. And independent expert put on by the plaintiff, Mr. Jeffrey Klug, who's well known in this town, a paediatric neurosurgeon, he said that it was well known that steroids over a 24-hour period would have decreased her raised intracranial pressure and she would have done better. There was no evidence led about the time frame in question, which was actually 18 hours, because the court accepted that it would take 6 hours to organise a CT scan. So, 6 hours the court accepts, then there's only an 18-hour window, and there's no evidence, there was no evidence before the court about the effect of steroids or draining extra fluid off the brain for the plaintiff in that period. So there's just no evidence before the court on which it could make a finding of causation, and certainly not to the level of on the balance of probabilities. The trial judge found that the loss of chance was 40%, and that was purely a estimate by the trial judge based really on no supporting evidence. The Court of Appeal disagreed and thought that loss of chance was in the order of 15%. Again, there's no firm evidence on which to base that. So if you're looking at a case of loss of chance, really very careful attention, as always, is paid to what expert evidence is going to be put forward to prove the loss of chance. An appropriate comparator must be found for the plaintiff's condition. And the cases that best lend themselves to this are the delay of diagnosis of cancer, because there are large amounts of statistics available. The Anti-Cancer Council keeps very careful records. Every person who's diagnosed with cancer in Victoria is registered with the, I think they're now called the Cancer Council, aren't they? Not the Anti-Cancer Council. And so very careful records are kept. And so statistics about survival and effective treatments are very well kept and relatively easily able to be given by experts, usually oncologists. So an appropriate comparator needs to be found. And if it's a very rare medical condition or the effects are not clear, then the case would clearly be a difficult case. Pleadings need can still plead loss of a chance. Loss of a chance has not gone away. It's just that how we think of loss of a chance has to change in terms of the burden of proof. That is, if causation is not met to 51% or more, then the case will not succeed. So the case can still be pleaded as loss of chance, but it has to be very clearly pleaded as loss of a chance of a better medical outcome, and the, how the case is put needs to be clearly articulated in the pleadings. Contract ought to be pleaded, as Paul mentioned, in the case of course, this can only be pleaded in the case of competent adults. If the case involves a child or a legal minor or a person under a disability, those people will be thought of as not being able to form contracts with their treating doctors, and so contract won't apply to legal minors. As Paul mentioned, what damage is being claimed has to be clearly pleaded. So in the case of Tibetan Get, Rima Get had significant brain damage already from the existence of the tumour and the treatment that was always going to be required in any event, notwithstanding the delay of 24 hours in treatment. And the court made an assessment that she had suffered 75% of her brain injury just consequent to the effect of the tumour. And so it needs to be pleaded very carefully. That portion of the damage, if it's not the entire of the plaintiff's injury, has to be articulated in the pleadings of injury. In conclusion, I'd like to briefly put this case into the context of the development of the common law of medical negligence in recent times. And that is that most people in this room will be well aware that the High Court has over recent years not extended the scope of negligence at all. And in fact, some might argue have narrowed the scope of negligence. I'm mindful of the decisions in CSR and Eddy, where the High Court said Sullivan and Gordon type damages are not allowed. That is, the doctrine of Griffiths and Kirkemeyer will not be extended to include the value of attendant care provided by the injured person to others. There's Ellis and Amica, where the High Court said very clearly causation, again, has to be proven to 51% or more for that breach. This was a mesothelioma case caused by asbestos, where the plaintiff also smoked, where the court found that overwhelmingly the cause of the plaintiff's lung cancer was cigarette smoking and not asbestos. Fits in a coherent way with the determination here in Tibet and Get. And then finally, of course, this decision where loss of a chance, causation less than 51% or more, will not succeed. So there's been no, after a period really in the 80s and 90s, where there was expansion of the scope of negligence with Nagel and Rottnest Island Authority being the high watermark, if you'll excuse the pun in that diving case, being the high watermark of the expansion of the scope of negligence under which plaintiffs can claim, really the last 5, 6, 10 years has seen a narrowing of that scope, certainly no further expansion. I'm not sure that Nagel would survive a High Court decision today.
Thank you very much, Sharon and Paul. Just one thing I respectfully perhaps disagree with Sharon slightly on the question of contract. I see no reason why a person under a disability becoming a patient would prevent them bringing a claim for contract. I think a contract would still be imputed, and usually that person under a disability would have someone give authority for procedures, and that person would be acting on behalf of the child or other person under a disability to make a claim. So I wouldn't give up that just yet, notwithstanding Sharon's reference. I think that I was going to ask about the implications of Amica and Ellis and other cases recently. I think it's a very good point that you've raised, Sharon, that there is a definite shift over recent years, perhaps not 10 years, but certainly since Justice Kirby left, in the court, and the previous embracing of more general concepts is unlikely to be expanded and probably will contract over the next few years. No questions? You're obviously keen to get out into the sunshine. Thank you very much for coming. Before I ask you to thank the speakers, just you'll be kept abreast of other sessions that Greens List is having, and if you look at their website, there's plenty of information there about forthcoming seminars. So thank you very much, and please thank the speakers.